Testing, check one. Your bill on. Are you ready?
Are you? I'm ready. We're going to call the Senate Education Committee on February 7th to order. And again, generally on our, we have possible introduction of committee measures. We don't have any today, so we're going to move on and we're going to get started because there's people who have things to do. And so with that, we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 8. And we'll have our administrator give a short explanation of the bill. And the fact, I think we have some amendments as well. So with that, Senator Courtney, you want to come on up and we'll give an explanation.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 8 allows a community college and a public university to merge if the Higher Education Coordinating Commission approves. It requires merging institutions to submit a joint proposal to HEC that meets certain requirements. It requires HEC to submit a report to the legislature at least 90 days prior to the effective date of the merger. It originally removed certain provisions of state law, including the requirement that community colleges be located within commuting time of a majority of students, the prohibition on community colleges offering baccalaureate degrees, and the prohibition on spending state funds for dormitories or athletic facilities for spectator sports on community college campuses. The dash one amendments remove those removals.
Okay, with that.
Chair Boland, Vice Chair Wickham, members of the Senate Committee on Education, my name is Peter Courtney. I'm a state senator in District 11, which includes portions of Salem, and then goes up through Jervis and Woodburn. I've never felt so alone in my life testifying for a bill, and that's why I've asked my legislative assistant, Lisa Herzog, to join me, as well as Dan Gilbert, the legislative counsel who drafted the bill and the amendments, and will be prepared to answer any of the technical questions you may have. No one asked me to introduce this bill, no organization, no individual. This is all about something. It's my bill, came about, which I won't go into, something we attempted at Western Oregon back in 2006. But of course, nothing came to fruition. The bill is, your outstanding analyst has already described to you, so I'll simply say last session, Senator Mark Hess, who is a member of this August committee, worked hard on attempting to provide an affordable path for community college for the state of Oregon. And through his leadership, we did that, and I'd like to think we've done something rather significant to help our fellow Oregonians get some education that perhaps they wouldn't have gotten. But the most important thing that bill did was to bring the focus back on the student, which sometimes, this is my opinion, these are all my opinions, given how long I've lived in life and spent some time around education. Sometimes it gets away from the student. I know that we say it's always the student, but I sometimes think that's not the case. Senate Bill 8 creates a clear path from a community college education to a four-year degree. It allows for a community college and a four-year university to jointly and voluntarily submit a plan to the Higher Education Coordinating Committee to work together to reduce administrative costs by merging the two respective schools. Therefore, the two respective governing boards would have to decide they want to do it. It's totally voluntary. We want to create one administration for these new entities, one president instead of two, one provost, one human resource director, one legal department, one dean of students. Often dean of students today are not referred to dean of students. They're referred to, as some of you know, as vice president of student affairs, et cetera, et cetera. Working together, the two institutions can be both leaner and stronger. 6 and 8 college graduates leave school owing at least $26,000 or more. I believe that figure is low. I'm convinced it's closer to $30,000. The prospect of that amount of debt scares many students from attempting to go on and get the kind of education that would fulfill who they are and who we perhaps would benefit as society from. The bill not only saves students tuition by cutting administrative overhead, but also allows more flexibility around where and how students can earn degrees and certificates. The average cost of in-state tuition, as you know, for full-time students at your public colleges in the state is $8,503 compared to $5,455 at a community college. Additionally, students at community colleges often live at home, saving an average of $9,315 per year in room and board. Even without the Oregon Promise, students can save more than $6,000 in tuition, $18,000 in room and board, by choosing a community college for the first 2 years of their post-secondary education. Transferring from community college to a four-year university, however, can be daunting for students. By allowing an administrative merger between a community college and a four-year university, SB 8 would reduce the transitional challenges. As partners, the two institutions could guarantee a curriculum continuity that would assure students that their community college credits would count towards their bachelor's degree. Many colleges and universities in the great state of Oregon are working on innovative ways to ensure that students are able to graduate. This bill is one more option to help colleges save money and serve students. I've been told by counsel that this is a completely new idea, one that does require legislation to allow for this process. Therefore, this is not just a bogus bill that's come before you. Learned and High Counsel is here with me to explain that, should you think it's necessary. This cannot be done without a bill. One size does not fit all when it comes to education. Now I'm going to read a statement that's going to get me in trouble. It's not part of the testimony. But, you know, when you get old, you get old. You've heard what this bill does. Here's what the bill means. At least what I would like it to mean. Higher education has got to change if truly going to serve the people, the students. For generations, higher education has been a hierarchy, with Ivy Leagues at the top, followed by expensive private schools and big-name state schools, and then the regional universities and community colleges at the bottom. We've created a society that sees community colleges or technical schools as consolation prizes. This has created different classes of people and has only widened the division between the rich and the poor. We have to change that. All students should be encouraged to reach their full potential. We should support every student on whatever path they choose. If they go straight from high school to a four-year school, they should be able to afford it. If they transfer from a community college, they shouldn't lose their credits. If they return to school as adults, they should have evening and weekend classes available. If they choose to take advantage of more than 300 career and technical education programs offered at community colleges around this state, their choice should be supported and their contributions valued. This bill is as much about opportunity as it is cost savings. By merging some of these institutions and offering a variety of degrees and CTE programs all under one roof, it is my hope that students of all walks will be able to achieve their potential. The kid who never saw himself as a college person could easily see a path from an EMT certification to a pre-med bachelor's degree without having to leave his community college. The art history major could leave their 400-level classes on Renaissance painters and head across campus to finish their entrepreneurial and small business operation certificate so they can open and run their own gallery after graduation. A student whose parents have only ever pushed her towards a major university can register for automotive mechanic technology and finally explore her passion for fast cars and working with her hands. This bill is an attempt to break down barriers between universities and community colleges, between rich and poor, and between urban and rural, and between Oregon students and their degrees. I know it's a different idea. I know some of you think it is a crazy idea, a preposterous idea. But if we don't change how higher education system operates, we're going to leave a lot of students behind, and Oregon is going to lose out and a lot, as well as lose out on a lot of potential. So I do want to thank you very much for even being willing to hear this bill. I'm sure you took a chance in doing it, Mr. Chair. I came before the committee during legislative days to simply outline the concept. It's voluntary. It's not mandatory. There is an amendment involved. As I say, we once started down this path at Western Oregon University and Chemeketa Community College in a meeting in 2006 between the two respective presidents and the two provosts and a guy named Peter, and it broke down pretty quickly. I'm just going to tell you because of egos. Somebody realized there that someone was going to no longer be a president or a provost, at least in concept or theory, if you go down this route. And that's okay. That's fine. But it's always stuck with me because we actually asked for a bill to be drafted then, and then I departed from it. I still think it's a major idea. This is a remarkable state. You have 17 community colleges. That's remarkable. You have 7 public universities in the state, as you know. You have your 3 big ones, and then you have the 3 or smaller universities or 2 schools, etc. This is not some kind of sneak plan or anything like that, but it is an attempt to try to maybe create a structure that is novel and new, and in the end would really give affordability and accessibility a new meaning for our young people, middle-aged people, and even older people who want to access the education system. So with that, I'm done. You were very gracious to let me talk.
Any questions for Senate President? Yes, Senator Hatch.
Thank you. Mr. President, I don't think you're crazy. I very much support this concept, and it sort of seems like it's continuing this process we started maybe 6 or 7 years ago to restructure post-secondary education to make it more affordable, more flexible, and away from those, I don't know, the old days of kids wearing sweaters and under big trees going to classes. And I just think we need to keep pushing on this. All of us have legislative aides, it seems. We're buried in college debt, and that's part of the reality of the status quo.
Other questions? Yes, Senator Lipcomb.
Senator Courtney, do you see a real, it is voluntary, you stress that. Do you see community colleges becoming satellites, if you will, of universities? Is that the way you would envision this working in a practical sense? You'll recognize in my counties out in the rural portion, we have community colleges, and they have a different service model. They're servicing anyone, as you mentioned, the 35-year-old, the 38-year-old, the 52-year-old, the guy who never got a college degree, et cetera. And anybody and everybody's always welcome, and that's the low end of the budget regime that you're describing. And then the university system's a little bit different with applications and acceptance and that higher level, whether it's appropriate or inappropriate, I'm not getting into. But I'm just curious if in a practical sense, when these two entities voluntarily combine, how do you see that working with the campus structure that's in place?
Chair Overton, Senator Lithicum, first of all, they would have to submit a plan to HEC. The Community College Board would be as much a player as the board governing the 4-year institutions. As I said, there are 300 different selections in your community colleges. I here have a copy of the incredible number of courses in your community colleges. That's the last thing that Peter Michael Corley wants to do, is do away with those selections of those courses. That's the last thing I want to do, is to do away with any of the 17 community colleges and what they bring to the students in the state of Oregon. I can tell you, I've been thinking about this. I am very jealous of Senator Lee Beyer, and maybe I'd probably say Senator Jeff Cruz because I think he's there. I would give anything to be able to use my hands. You don't want to see me with a screwdriver or a saw or a hammer. I would give anything to be able to do that. Had this kind of concept enlisted in my life, I'll bet you on the side I would have taken additional classes in the crafts to work with my hands. Do you see what I mean? I would have done that. I was pursuing a liberal arts degree in political science, English, and history. If the University of Rhode Island had connected up with the community college in Rhode Island that I'd come from, I know I would have gone there to learn those skills as well. So that's the last thing I want to do. In some way, I'm trying to educate the whole person, or at least them, give them that opportunity. And if I don't keep the community college in whole in here, that won't be done at all. Not at all. I'm very proud. You got 17 community colleges. Each of you have them in your areas. Dynamic. 300 classes. I'm not even sure that's it. My staff, Lisa, I'm not going to read all this. It's incredible. That's not at all. Not at all. And don't forget, you can't force it on a community college here. Their board has got to get together with the board of the four-year institution and bring it to heck. So I think that the answer to your question, not at all, that is my intention. In fact, the total opposite. I want that plethora of classes available to all the students there, regardless of whether you're getting a four-year degree or whatever you want to do.
Yes.
In terms of follow-up, I appreciate your perspective. Do you see this? What I hear in your strategy is getting credits to transfer easily through that unification process. And HEC has a responsibility today of unifying the transfer of credits. Is that correct?
Yes.
Chair Bowman, Senator Lithicum, I believe the answer is yes, but I'm going to defer to your chair and other experts who may or may not be on the committee as well as your staff on that. I believe the answer is correct, but it varies, and to me, it's a mixed bag, and that's all I'm going to say in terms of at least the perception of it. I'll leave it at that. I'm not trying to not answer your question. I'm struggling with it to be as accurate as I can within the time limits I have.
Okay.
I think that from my read of the bill and the way it works, this would eliminate some of the ongoing conversations right. that the university system is having with community colleges with respect to transfer of credits and so on, because they would be the same school, so it would change that
in
a way that hasn't happened to this point. It's getting much better. They're working very hard at it, but it's still an issue.
And can I just say I could almost kiss the chair, don't get me wrong, because he said it so much better than I can, and he is a former principal, of the Marshfield High School, and this is his world. But he said it better. That's the whole idea. We wouldn't be talking about transfers because this structure would just sort of, they would be able to acknowledge it in a way we don't get into the bureaucracy of it. But he said it so much better than me. Do you want to testify on my bill, Senator Bowman?
We'll have to work on that.
Yeah, hand me the gavel. Yeah.
That's right. We're going to do that later.
just a follow-up with regard to your comment is well taken. And in terms of that issue, we're describing a community college and a four-year university that meld, if you will. I'm concerned about all of those community colleges getting to all of the universities and having credits transfer. That's the best way out of this, menagerie that we find ourselves in. Those credits ought to be transferable, and transferring those credits is our goal, then we ought to strive at transferring those credits. That in turn would lead to what you're describing, where curriculums coalesce or get created that have a common level of attainment or instruction or whatever those categories might be. And then we actually have that individual who's out in Eastern Oregon be successful in transferring to Portland. And I think the little hand motions you made, if there's clarification on that issue, be all inclusive, I'd love to hear clarification.
Well, my bill is, Senator Chair Bowden, Senator Liz, you have to understand, when you're in a four-year institution, you think four-year institution. When you're in a community college, you think community college. Students in college, I think it when I was last at Western, they changed their majors anywhere from 4 to 7 times over 4 years. Unheard of when I was in college. Unheard of. I was told the major I picked, I had to stick with at URI back in 1901. It wasn't that long ago, but it was that situation. Today, students change their majors dramatically. They don't even know what they're going to do when they get their bachelor's degree, most students. And you may not like hearing that, but it's the absolute truth. If they were in an academic setting where the future was unlimited in terms of where to go, the issue of transfers wouldn't even be coming up. That's the thing. A student, once they make the move to 4 years, they are taking away the options that many of the options that community college will always offer them. Community college students often can't even think of the 4 year because of debt. And that is what I'm trying to break down here as much as possible, if you understand. Yes, the transfer issue, if you want to talk about that, work on that. This model attempts to not even to go well beyond all that, to give the student a way of thinking that we don't allow students to have today. We don't even think, professors don't think that way, instructors don't think that way, teachers don't think that, presidents, administrators don't think that way. They don't think that way. They really don't. They're in these worlds. And while I'm making a general statement, it's just the way it is, because we've created these two concepts, a community college and a four-year institution. Magnificent. But to the student, and the way the world is developing, I mean, I can tell you, most students at Western, I can't tell you the number of times I've had graduations. They come, they got a degree, so I don't know what I'm going to do, most of them. My own sons have gone through this. My own sons changed their degrees dramatically going through 40, and they're much younger than me. So the transfer thing, I'll defer to you and how you want to do. If you want to pass more laws to make it efficient or seamless so people can transfer, then go for it. That is not what this is about to a large extent. It's much different, trying to reduce costs, get a greater access and affordability, to create a whole new dynamic concept for education of our people in all areas, with your hands, your feet, your mind, whatever.
Other questions? I guess I have as much a comment as a question, and I'll share it with you. The first community college in Oregon was Southwestern Oregon Community College in Coos Bay, and it came about in large part from one person, Mr. Hansen, who was a longshoreman in Coos Bay, who had seen this community college systems happening in other states. And he wanted to be the first. So he really worked hard at organizing the people. And it came out of an organic thing that said, we're going to have a community college that's here in our community to help our kids decide what they want to do. And with that was an elected board, college districts. There's a bill this session because we've got some places that are in college districts, but they don't get to vote in college stuff, and we're going to try to change some of that kind of stuff in the near future. So they came about as an organic movement around the country to make sure that middle-class kids from parents who were in World War II had a place to go and get an education. So I agree with you 100% about the origins of the community college. And they got filled with teachers that had lots of different backgrounds. And I agree again, they would not have been accepted at a university. A lot of the vocational teachers that work at community colleges come directly from the field. And they, you know, the only school that I think is similar would be down in your area, actually. If you look at the Tech College, they have some of those same kinds of people. So they have originated because of where they are in a different way that looks a lot more like what you're talking about, where there's an equal respect between that vocational teacher that's teaching diesel mechanics and that professor that's teaching English, which doesn't exist. I absolutely agree with what you're saying. If this can get those things to happen more organically so that people feel just as proud of a person that is a auto mechanic as they do a person that has their doctorate degree in geomorphology, that would be a wonderful thing for society because we've lost some of that in the last 40 years. So if this bill is doing that, I need to keep working at it. The issue with me about elected boards with areas and universities which serve the whole and don't have that is something that I've got to get in my head to figure out how does that look as we go forward. How does that work, actually, in the sense of where it's at? And where does that ownership that those local communities did to put their school together? You know, we just a couple of years ago put the statue of our person that really got this all going and had all these labor people come to Coos Bay to talk about Southwestern's beginnings. So I want to figure out, and I keep looking at it and see what else is out there, to say how do we raise the feelings that all people have for instructors of all kinds that are giving kids opportunities to go and become whatever they want to become. If you listen to PBS and you listen to our mechanic guys who have these degrees from Harvard or whatever, what they really are excited about is the motor and the stuff. That's a perfect example of the kind of respect. They have a lot of respect from a lot of people when you listen to that TV radio show. Did they get the respect because they know more about cars than anybody I've ever heard, or did they get the respect because they went to these Ivy League schools? I don't know. But the reality is they know stuff better than a whole lot of us do. So I would love, and we'll keep looking at this bill. I'll keep trying to figure out from other people what the perspectives are and how we do that. I do appreciate that it's voluntary. I do appreciate the amendments because I think there was a bit of concern with regard to whether all community colleges had the right to make baccalaureate degrees, which might have made them really excited. in a different way. And so I think the amendments help with some of that kind of stuff, and I appreciate the work that continues to go on this bill. And I just want to, I'm going to check personally with a lot of these other people out there and say, how does this disrupt or do things that we need to, we need to understand the unintended consequences of the kinds of things, because this is a radical change. I like radical change. So I'm not opposed to that. But again, thank you for bringing it. Thanks for having the conversation. We'll see how it goes from there. Any comments you want to make?
Well, you're much more articulate and learned than I am. You've spoken so much better than I have about this concept. I will say one last thing. Economics are going to drive. You will have a president one day. You will. I'm going to predict it. Maybe not in my lifetime. It's going to move in this direction. You cannot continue to build these residence halls. I'm going to tell you right here and now. I know more than I'm letting on here. The bottom line often is not the student. It is not the student. We got to maintain the residence halls to be filled. I could go on and on here. And I want to tell you now, economics is going to drive this. You have 7 public universities in this state. State of Washington has 5. I'm not saying I want to be like State of Washington. Truth is, I revere the true schools in the state, Western Oregon them. And I will tell you something. I review the 17 community colleges. I can for the life of me understand. I cannot for the life of me understand, given the hardships that some of the public universities have struggled with and others, why there hasn't been more attempt to try to bring them together in a way that is in the best interest of students, maintaining both what they do in our society. And I sincerely mean that. I don't understand that. I don't understand it, but I think I know why, and I won't get into the people's basic human nature. This is no threat. This is not a mandate on your community college, your universities. It is a voluntary. Because we've taken a step I wish we hadn't. You're not going to like hearing this, gentlemen, because I was driven there and tried to stop it. I don't like all these independent boards. We decided to do that. But the board of every university would have to join with the board of a community college and say, let's see about this. So I'm not shoving it down any part of the states. I'm not saying it's the best thing ever, but it is a model. Somewhere, someone is going to move in this direction. I just know it. I just know it is because of economics. You've been great to me. Spoken very well. Thank you for your patience, and I appreciate it very much. Yes.
Thank you.
One follow-up here as we close, yes. If I may, Chair. Your closing statements are spot on. In the same way we have witnessed the internet, Amazon, brick and mortar failure of retail, empty malls, et cetera, across America, in the next 10 years, the education market is going to change dramatically. And the brick and mortar concept, the school districts and the schools and whatever that we have sprinkled throughout, will not survive the technology impetus that we're facing. It's a demographic and technological change that we've never seen in our lifetimes. So your comments are spot on, and I appreciate you speaking so frankly.
Thank you. You've been very kind to me. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
I can't believe I didn't get any questions. I'm sorry.
So as of right now, there is no one else signed up to talk about this bill. Is there anyone who forgot to sign up or is so excited about the opportunity to get in front of a microphone, knowing you're going to be recorded, you want to get up there? I don't see that person. Well, there's somebody standing up. But they're leaving us. So,
scared them away is what you did.
So. Anyway, with that, we will close our public hearing on Senate Bill 8, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 207. And with that, we'll have a short explanation of the bill, and I'm going to invite. Pamela Kerouac up to talk about the bill. And we'll have our other person that has a plane to catch. So thank you from College Board. Yeah. And we're going to have a staff summary first, and then we'll let you talk.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, the bill requires public universities and community colleges to give credit beginning in the 2018-19 school year for students who participated in an advanced placement program and received a successful grade on a nationwide examination. It suggests that the definition of a successful grade would be a score of 3 or higher on an advanced placement exam.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Pam Kerouac. I'm Senior Director for the College Board, AP Higher Ed Policy. I serve as an advocate for fair and consistent and evidence-based state and system-wide AP policy. And this is a good bill because what you will be doing is reducing the friction and the transfer issues we see when colleges and universities across the state have different cut scores for what is required to grant credit for AP. So in your packet, you will see we've provided some documents, and I think most important is the grid for the four-year institutions and for the two-year. Do you each have a packet in front of you?
It's online.
It's online. Okay, great. Anyway, so in these two documents, you'll see a cut score, and you'll see the blue shading indicates any score higher than a 3 that is required in order to grant credit for AP. Some of the blank cells simply represent there is no policy. So we collect this data from Oregon colleges and universities annually through the College Board Annual Survey of Colleges. They tell us what the cut score is for granting credit, but they don't necessarily report to us what kind of credit. So two issues come from this. One, some students will get credit, some students will not. We don't know for those students who do get credit for a score of 3 at a community college if they have to repeat that course when they transfer to a four-year university. We also know that many of the institutions say they grant credit for scores of 3 or 4, but the credit is actually elective credit. So when a student accumulates an excess of elective credit, that's not helpful. They're not using that credit to meet degree requirements. And we see that in the state of Oregon, the rates for college completion, according to the Chronicle of Higher Ed 2013 data, is a concern. So at this 2013 report, I see 30%. Actually, I want to take a look and make sure I have it correct. 30.3% rate of college graduation for 4 years, and 50.5% rate of graduation in 6 years. So I want to draw attention to the current research that we've done for AP. Two of the most outstanding findings are that students earning credit for scores of 3 in placement validity studies do as well or better than the college student who earns grades of C, B, and A. So we use those placement validity studies to really draw attention to what's an evidence-based policy. How do you identify the appropriate cut score for AP subjects at your colleges and universities? And so we ask that the faculty review the content of the curriculum, the student learning outcomes, the comparability studies, the validation studies, and the placement validity studies that we're annually engaged in reporting. Without that diligence to what's available, transparently available, we find that oftentimes faculty are providing a very subjective idea about what students should present in terms of scores for credit. In terms of the potential cost savings, this is a document where we say when we think about the return on investment for taxpayers in Oregon, we know you're supporting AP in many, many ways. You're supporting the increase in participation. You're supporting low-income exam fees. So your return on investment should be that students are able to maximize that achievement for college credit. In fact, if every student who had a score of 3 on exam in the state of Oregon were able to earn that college credit, the savings for 2016 would be $18,627,000 to students and families in Oregon. When you look at the back page of this document, you'll see, probably not surprising, but we see a significant percentage of low-income, Hispanic, and African-American students scoring 3. These students often are traditionally underrepresented students. We know that there's an effort to diversify our enrollment in our colleges and universities, yet when these students present scores of 3, they're denied college credit. So they're doubly disadvantaged in terms of their engagement in AP, their performance on AP, and their inability, at no fault of theirs, to earn college credit. There may be questions about what a score of 3 and a 4 and a 5 actually mean. So in the comparability studies, we actually invite higher ed faculty who teach introductory college courses to use the AP curriculum with their students. They also use an exam from AP to measure that student's performance at the end of U.S. history. The faculty members work with us to tell us how well A students, B students, and C students do in that course using AP curriculum. That starts the standard-setting process for AP scoring. We then have rubrics that identify achievement levels for A, B, and C that equate to scores of 5, 4, and 3. So in other words, a score of 3 represents a passing grade of C as demonstrated by college students themselves. We also engage higher ed faculty throughout the entire development of AP curriculum. So many courses in the AP program have been redesigned in the last 4 to 5 years. The important part of that redesign was really to engage with AACNU and the LEAP initiatives, which I know Oregon is a strong partner in, to include in the curriculum an emphasis on critical thinking, the depth of learning, integrative learning, and adaptive learning. In other words, how do I adapt the knowledge I'm gaining from this course in ways that are meaningful to me? So when we say we are completely aligned with general education as it's being reformed now in Oregon and many states, we're serious about that. We've worked with AACNU and the vice president in the development of the redesign of AP curriculum. We've also worked with WICHE Passport to ensure the portability of AP credit, not just within the colleges and universities within your state, but across the states in their multi-state collaborative. So we encourage and we invite faculty input, but we also really want to encourage your guidance and your support on ensuring that the scores that are determined by faculty are evidence-based. Do you have a comment?
No.
Okay.
You can identify yourself for everybody, though.
He's tired of listening to me talk.
For the record, Terry Whitney, I'm the Government Relations Director for the College Board.
So, questions?
No questions.
Yes. Senator Hess.
Since I learned about this bill the other day, I'm supportive, but I've been getting some emails from constituents wondering, okay, what happens to IB courses? Where do they fit into this?
Oftentimes, AP, IB, CLEP, and other acceleration mechanisms will find themselves in the same bill. We believe that a rising tide lifts all boats. So fair and consistent policy for all accelerated mechanisms that are standard and nationally respected, yes, we support as an included piece of this bill.
So we should amend it then to include language like that? All.
I think you'd have to get the IB folks to weigh in.
That's the solution there, right? Not just one group.
Yeah.
Other questions?
No.
I appreciate that answer because I agree. I think IB, a bunch of the others do really great work in preparing kids at levels that are college meet college requirements. And from a parent perspective, I had a number of my kids who took AP courses, and when they went to the University of Oregon, it counted for them. They got credit. One went to USC. It counted, or at least it allowed her, as a theater major, to not take other courses that she didn't want to take. So from her perspective, it was better than, and it did count. So there, as we know, there are a lot of places that do. In their cases, they got the 4 or 5. I do know a lot of kids who had threes who I really believed had worked as hard as I've ever seen kids at high school work, and it could have been helpful. College Board, and I would love to talk to the IB people, and I know there's some here in the audience that are going to talk, but maybe include them in this and have that conversation. From my perspective, I got to know, well, we had three or four of our students, I guess it's three of our kids who were on the College Board Student Advisory Committee, so they would fly out of Coos Bay and go to New York and be a part of that board while they were in high school. And then when they were in college, they stayed on the board because they had a four-year, I think it was a four-year term. And we got to know more about what was going on with SAT, College Board, all of these things than I would have ever, I wish most high schools would have had the opportunity to do that, because those kids came back really knowledgeable about testing and a whole bunch of other things because of the conversations you have. So I wanted to thank you personally for those kids that had that opportunity. So
thank you.
Not really a question. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we do have a few people, and nobody looks like came from over 100 miles, which is really nice. Just so you know, if you came, well, you might have come from more than 100 miles, but we try to make sure that if they do, that we give them some preference. So we'll go by just the sign-up. So Aaron Weeks, Tim Cowan, and Chuck Chamberlain.
Chair?
Yes.
I've enjoyed what you and the committee have been doing and the questions and so on. I want to wait.
Okay. Thanks, Chair. Thank you. Yep, perfect.
Ready?
Yes, we're ready.
Hello, Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Linthicum, and members of the committee. My name is Erin Weeks Earp. I am a policy specialist with the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. I'm here to provide an overview of our process for determining the advanced placement and international baccalaureate statewide course credit policy. This overview should be useful as you consider Senate Bill 207. Around credits awarded for advanced placement exam scores. So the HEC inherited the statewide work group for advanced placement and international baccalaureate course credit from the former Oregon University system in 2014. For short, we'll call this group the APIB work group or policy work group. This APIB policy work group has been meeting since 2005. When, upon passage of Senate Bill 342, Oregon's public colleges and universities were directed to develop uniform standards for awarding college credit for advanced placement. Later, the Joint Boards of Education directed the work group to include the International Baccalaureate program in their work. The policy consists of a tabulated list of exam subjects, scores, and the number of credits or courses to be awarded. The policy represents consensus among Oregon institutions on minimum scores and transferable credits. It is designed to provide transparency and consistency to students as they plan their high school course taking, exam taking, and post-secondary degrees and certificates. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about our process. I'll be brief, and then I'd love to take your questions. Each academic year, our review process uses the following timeline. The policy is updated over three work group meetings, so it's updated every year. There's one in-person meeting and two phone meetings. Before the first work group meeting in the fall, staff, HEC staff, connects with the higher education liaisons from the College Board and the International Baccalaureate Organization, so with PAM and with our contact at the IB. And we confirm the subjects that have been updated or reviewed by those organizations in the given year ahead of when the exams will be offered to our Oregon students. So both organizations publish those calendars of their curricular review 2 to 3 years ahead. Early in October, the work group has a first meeting to establish the annual review of subjects, select their meeting dates, and to confirm receipt of the materials that are shared with their academic departments on campus. So the committee is made up of primarily administrators who are liaisons to each department depending on which subject is under review. The materials include AP curriculum frameworks, IB subject guides, and as available summary briefs that outline the changes to curriculum. After the winter break, the work group has a second meeting to compare the department faculty recommendations and recommended equivalencies and to make tentative revisions to our statewide policy. In February or early March, so the third meeting this year is going to happen in March, the work group meets a third and last time to share department feedback and make adjustments. The work group members return to departments as necessary. A bit of negotiation takes place, and the final policy is recommended. During the spring, after the final policy is recommended, the policy is presented to a number of groups in the state for vetting: the Oregon Public University Provost Council, the Oregon Community College Council of Instructional Administrators, the Joint Articulation and Transfer Committee, and the State Board of Education. After all this, it goes to the HEC Subcommittee for Student Success and Institutional Collaboration for review and approval, and then finally for the commission, the HEC Commission, for adoption. When the policy is adopted, it's on the HEC website and distributed to the work group members and others as needed, so that high school counselors, teachers, students, and parents can have access to it. That concludes my overview of our process for determining the Advanced Placement and International Baccalaureate statewide course credit policy. I welcome any questions you have.
We'll wait, then we'll ask
and,
both at the same
yeah,
time.
Yeah, I'd like to hear from you.
Thanks.
Hi, my name is Chuck Chamberlain. I'm an IB International Baccalaureate teacher and coordinator at South Salem High School, just up the street. But I'm here to represent all of the IB diploma programs in the state of Oregon. There are 19 of them. And to make this short and sweet, Senator Haas already stole my thunder, is all we're really asking is for that IB in the language of the bill gets included, or that we don't get access to the same sort of thing, because it could be confusing. If you look at the bill, it says lowercase advanced placement, and then it says uppercase advanced placement. So what we're asking, what I'm asking, is just to make sure that this policy includes the International Baccalaureate program. And I understand, Senator Haas, one of your staff members is an IB diploma candidate, or excuse me, an IB diploma student from Bend. So, and I was going to go into what Aaron already said, so I'm done.
So questions? I guess the part that, as a high school principal, and I guess I stopped being a high school principal about the same time your organization got started, so I can't say to it, but I will tell you that it was exceedingly frustrating as a high school person and a counselor to counsel kids that were taking AP. I mean, most of them took it for, and I would assume that's true with IB at the same time, because you'd say, we really think it's important to take these classes because they will really prepare you for college. And they say, well, will I get anything for it? Well, do you know what college you're going to or you have gotten accepted to? And the counsel would say, what you need to do is once you take the test and get a score, call the college or the university you've been accepted to and you can figure it out. We couldn't tell them anything about whether their course would count or not. That was not real acceptable to some. To many of them, it was the challenge of taking the courses and doing the work was enough. But for another of them, including parents, it was kind of like, maybe I should take a 2+2 program. It guarantees me I get community college credit and I can go forward. It made it difficult to have real conversations with kids. And what you're telling me you do every year, so do the things change each year about how many credits you're going to get for each course? Is there any predictability with regard to it? Is there a new group on the committee that tells kids, now I can, oh, don't look at the deal before you take the class, look at the deal after you've taken the class, because that's the one that's going to count for you? That's the question.
So the policy speaks to exams taken in the year. So a course credit policy is for an academic year. Yeah. Usually the high school students will use those exams during the next academic year or the following. Not the scores do not change very much. Only the reviewed subjects might change. Sometimes they stay the same. If the departments review the changes in curriculum and decide whether or not they were significant enough to warrant a change in our statewide policy.
So the answer, basically, the student won't know until after they've taken the course what that academic year's courses will actually mean for them if they go to a university. And that works for both community college and for the university. They're the same?
Yes, the policy is the same for universities and community colleges. The policy is a recommended minimum. It does include both scores of 3 and 4, depending on the subject. And hopefully, for the situation that you described, a high school counselor or a student could look at our policy and know in the subjects that they're thinking about testing in what the guaranteed amount of course credit is at Oregon Public's.
But yeah. The year before, right.
Yeah.
And then they wait until after they've taken the course to find out what it is for that year, though theoretically it would be similar.
It most often is similar, and hopefully when they've taken the course and they find out their score, they send their score to the university. I think that's the gap that we need to work the hardest at.
Okay. Any other questions?
No.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here.
You bet. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
So next we have Morgan Allen, John Wyckoff, and Kendra Crowley.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. Morgan Allen here on behalf of the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, and just wanted to add a slight K-12 perspective to the discussion today. Certainly a lot of the comments are pertinent to what I was planning on saying, so I'll skip right to the point. I think really for us, there's two things. As you've said to this committee, particularly over the last few years, there's been a huge emphasis on dual credit fifth-year programs, IB, AP, doing more stuff while kids are in high school so that they can transfer those credits and make their college experience more affordable. And we think this is an important conversation about the threes versus fours. And, you know, one of the things that we hear from our members a lot is we're pushing all these students to do this dual credit and AP, IB, et cetera. And there's concerns about whether or not those kids will actually benefit from those credits when they get to college. Or if they work really hard and they get a 3 in a class and a particular college or community college or university won't accept a 3 where others may. So it may influence where they are able to go. And I think, you know, we're certainly not academic elitists at COSA, but if you go to the College Board's website, you can compare institutions. And I just did a quick check. I picked one random community college in Oregon, and then I picked Stanford, a school I would never, ever have a chance of getting into. And some of the standards for class AP courses for this community college were the same as Stanford's. And so I think those are, I think, a reasonable conversation to have is, you know, who's setting those standards? And if some of our nation's elite universities are requiring 4s or 5s, is that appropriate for all of our public institutions, which are supposed to provide access to kids that can't go to those elite institutions? Should they be requiring 4s or 5s, for example? So appreciate the opportunity to weigh in on this.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Wyckoff. I'm Deputy Director of the Oregon Community College Association, representing Oregon's 17 community colleges. I appreciate the opportunity to testify before you today. And I want to bring up some small concerns that we do have. While we, I would in some ways reiterate what my colleague just said about we very much support expanded opportunities for students to get college credit while in high school through a variety of different options, and we see this as another potential option, another current option. One of the areas where this bill is silent that this doesn't address is whether those credits transfer as credits into somebody's major or elective credits. our students face that sometimes when they transfer to universities in individual courses, just as high school students face it, could face it in this situation, where a score of a 3 in a certain sequence might get you part of that sequence once you get to a community college or a university, but you might have to take additional classes, or it may only count as elective credit. And this concept doesn't affect that one way or the other. And our concern is it doesn't, it may push students to take more of a certain kind of sort of accelerated credit, but it may not give them, it may not move them towards credits that move toward a degree. And one of the concerns there is students who are receiving financial aid are limited to 150% of credits attempted to continue receiving 150% of what it would require to get a degree for financial aid. And if you're racking up too many elective credits before you even get into your first year of post-secondary education, I mean, that can be an issue. So these are just, I think, part of the conversation that we would like to continue as we look at this concept and see if there are ways to address some of those. I think we had a question about the language. It says it's a score such as a 3. I think we'd want to be clear that doesn't imply possibly a 2 or something lower, and wonder if we want those numbers in statute. But with that, I will turn it over to Kendra Cawley, who's the Dean of Academic Affairs at Portland Community College, and who can probably be more elaborative on this than I can.
We'll see. Chair Roblin and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kendra Cawley. I'm the Dean of Academic Affairs for Portland Community College. I'm also currently the chair for the Joint Transfer and Articulation Committee, yes. The name changed. and I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today. I'd like to build a little bit on the conversation around the work that the APIB work group does, which is the intention of trying to make the applicability of AP and IB scores more uniform across the state, so that we don't have the problem that you alluded to earlier of having no clue as to what would count where. I want to reiterate the idea that the assignment of scores is done very thoughtfully by practitioners, by faculty in Oregon at the institutions, as a way of looking at whether the content and the degree of student mastery is aligned with the courses at our colleges and universities, and also to make sure that we maximize the value of the credit awarded to students. And so we're concerned a little bit that in some cases, for students awarding credit at the 3 level, if the faculty have judged it to be more appropriate at the 4, and also awarding credit for all of the AP that the student may have taken, may in some cases actually harm students in terms of, as John said, racking up elective credit that may not count towards a degree. So an example, one of my favorites, I used to be a biologist. I still am. biology, the biology exam, a score of 4 on the biology exam in Oregon will give students up to 15 credits, 3 courses in the major sequence at most of the schools. That's awesome. That is wonderful. But if the faculty have judged that a score of 4 does that, what does a score of 3 do? It's not in some sequence courses like that. Chemistry is the same way, I think physics. It's not always true that there's that all schools have the same content across the same sequence, and a score of 3 doesn't necessarily tell you which content areas may be a gap. And so what requiring a 3 to be accepted might end up doing is driving the faculty to say, well, it's not the whole major sequence if they got a 4, if they didn't get a 4. It would be something else. And that might not be, a lot of the students taking AP biology are aiming at a biology major, so that something else may not be as helpful. So that's just one example of how that might play out. A second concern that we had was that language in the bill suggests that credit will be given, actually it says, for each instance in which a student enrolled has participated in AP and received a score of 3. Our practice, the colleges and universities, is to award credit when a student asks for it. If there is an implication of some sort of automatic, we give credit for every AP class they've taken, I think that exacerbates the possibility of there being excess credits if the credits don't align well with what the student's intention is. And it's really important to us to not take away the student choice and the student thought about which courses they apply to their course of study. As was mentioned before, they change majors a lot now. And so having a lot of history credit may be a wonderful thing if you're a history major, but those same credits, if applied prematurely, when you turn around and be a biology major, they may count against you and rack up against that 150% that will apply to federal financial aid. So that is a concern as well. And then the third point I'd kind of like to make is that the when the student makes a request to have those AP scores recorded, the college has a significant responsibility to make sure that it's the best possible alignment with our curriculum and the expected standards within our curriculum. So let me give you another example. Statistics, currently on the list, that requires a 4. And it is typically recorded as Math 243 at most of the colleges and universities. That is a prerequisite for 244. If the faculty, in looking at the content, have determined that a 4 is sufficient to pass and a 3 is not, then when we award that statistics credit for a 3, we're setting the students up for being not successful in the subsequent course, in the follow-on course. And that applies a lot of places across the AP curriculum. So basically, I think there is an important element here. The common thread in what I'm trying to say is that the thoughtfulness with which the scores are developed by the faculty involved in this APIP work group should not be taken lightly. They're undertaken thoughtfully and with a firm eye to student success and to supporting students in the pathway that they want to take, as opposed to accumulating credits for credit's sake or credits that might not apply to their degree. So I would be happy to entertain questions.
Questions, anyone? I guess my question would be, have you done any studies over time with kids that have gotten 3s, 4s, or 5s, and how they did in the following sequence in whatever sequence they were at? Do you know how that has happened? Do you have any idea about whether kids that got 3s did really well the next year?
Not that I know of. That would be an interesting kind of tracking to do.
I agree.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Senator Lithgow and then Senator.
Yes. Earlier, the statistics that we heard alluded to the fact that 3s performed.
Performed well.
Right. So it would be interesting to know in terms of the IB how that looks.
It would be.
Representative Senator Gelser, I keep doing that.
We're only in your 3, so.
That's right. Yeah, but I had 8 years on the other side. You weren't there the whole time, but.
Most of it, but.
Yeah.
Gosh, I forgot my question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I've got it. Okay. I've got it. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So did I understand you correctly, and maybe I'm jumping to an inference that I shouldn't be making, but given the consideration that the faculty give to the scores, could an unintended consequence of passing this legislation be that students that previously used to get 3s would now get 2s because the faculty would not see that as credit worthy?
No, because the scores are awarded based on the performance on the test. So they would either get a 2 or a 3 on the test. It's what happens to the 3, I think, that is the unintended consequence. So right now, a student getting a 3 in a subject area where the minimum is a 4 would just not get the college credit, right? The concern is that if the faculty say, look, you really need a 4 in order to get credit for this sequence or this important prereq course, would be driven to say, okay, if we need to give credit for something for a 3, we'll give it to a different course, or in some cases it could be a generic course. When we have a subject area on our books, but we don't have a course that matches a curriculum, We will often give it like a biology 2XX. That kind of course doesn't do you much good for either gen ed or for a major or for going on to a prereq because it just is a placeholder for a biology course. And my concern is that would drive faculty to do is say, well, the 4 means this course and the 3 means this other course. And that's the unintended consequence I was trying to get at.
And follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. And so the consideration that the faculty are giving when they do that is if it's a biology 201 as the prereq to go into biology 202, the concern being that having the credit from that AP course is not going to set them up to be successful in that second course.
That would be the concern.
Thank you.
Other questions?
I understand what all of the suggestions and concerns are. It's still, when I transfer from College A to College B and I have a biology 101 or whatever it is, they don't make me retake the course usually. They transfer the credit. They assume that teacher had the same curriculum. We know that's not true. I've been in some of those and they weren't alike at all. Colleges expect, actually, that kids are taught how to learn in high schools and in college, and that part of their responsibility when they sign up for the next course is to figure out what they need to know to be able to get there. And a lot of kids do that. So I understand that. So the question for me oftentimes is, if the rigor is in the course and I get a 3, a C level, and the rigor is really there, there's no 2 history courses or whatever that are the same in any of our colleges. That's the reality of how our system works. The hope is that the rigor that is instilled in kids in doing that is going to carry over for them to attack the next course the same way. And if I had a C in any one of your courses, they'll let me take the next course. It's not going to be as easy as the kid that got the A or the B. I guarantee that because they're going to be missing something. But it doesn't slow them down in doing that. And I guess my feeling is have we found the rigor of those kids, the ones that come through AP courses, whether it's chemistry, biology, or whatever? And I was a biology and a math major, so I love that part.
I use you.
Is the rigor found to be that much different in these AP courses? At our schools, the rigor was – we didn't ever get a kid that came back and said, boy, college is so much harder. They almost always came back and said, wow, college is so much easier than the course that I went through. Because these high school kids, people take it very seriously. They get trained pretty well, and they want their kids to perform. So is there a rigor difference that you've found, or has that ever looked at?
I actually can't answer that question because okay. I haven't looked
at that. Okay.
Looked at that piece. But I do think that's part of the, as you mentioned before, the proof would really be in the data.
That's right. Thanks. Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have, it looks like, one more person, Lita Colligan. Hi, Lita. Is there anyone else out there that wants to sit up with Lita so she won't be by herself?
Yeah, I might need Kendra again. Okay. She's the expert.
Okay.
Good afternoon.
She's coming up. That's
okay.
Good.
Thanks. Good afternoon, Senator Roblin. Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Linthicum, and members of the committee. I'm Lita Colligan for the record. I work at Oregon Tech, but I'm here on behalf of Oregon's public universities. I submitted written testimony, so I know that you have it, and I'm not going to read my testimony to you. I want to reiterate some of the points that you've already heard from the community colleges here today. We have a deep respect at the universities for the work that goes on with this committee. We have faculty at the community colleges and the universities working together to ensure that we're assessing the exams the right way, calibrating the exams, participating in workshops with high school faculty, and trying to make sure that we're assigning the right scores and the right credits. In the testimony that I did submit, there is a link to the HEC policy, and I put that in there because I think it is very insightful. When you see the list of courses, the many, many courses, and that it isn't just a score, it's a range of credits that can be assigned for a score. So, for example, passing a calculus class with a 3, you might be able to get a 3 to a 5 depending on the exam this score that you got on an exam. So this gives the colleges and universities some flexibility in how many credits we offer, as well as ensuring students that they know that they will receive the college credits. So we fully support the intent of this bill. The colleges and universities have been working together for many years on this, for over a decade. We are supportive of awarding university credit to high school students who receive successful grades on advanced placement tests, in addition to the thousands of credits that we're already offering for IB and other accelerated credit. Through our partnerships with the colleges, we evaluate the exams, we attach appropriate credits, we seek to ensure that high school students will advance as quickly as possible, one of our goals. They don't repeat college credits unnecessarily, and that they're well prepared for the more advanced courses that they're going to take later. A couple of the questions you asked about the studies, I have not seen this, but I heard from Aaron, who was sitting next to me, that the U of O may have done a study on whether students persisted who took the AP tests. And they did find one thing that was interesting, and I could probably find this for you if you're interested, and that was that students who took a lot of these, got a lot of these AP credits, actually didn't take the next sequence. So in other words, they took them so they wouldn't have to take something in college, rather than because they were trying to be better prepared to advance more quickly, which I think is also an interesting piece of information. Also, Senator, one thing you raised, and that is that students don't have to actually take the course to take the exam. And so I can speak for my son, who took a whole bunch of AP courses, I mean exams, and he never took the courses in high school. So if you can, you know, show mastery of content, you can actually score on a test without ever having taken it. So it's hard to compare even at some point whether that's, you know, college is harder than high school if you've just learned the stuff on your own. Anyway, back to my testimony here, I wanted to just say that we would suggest that in many cases a score of 3 is considered a successful grade in almost all of these, and if you go to the list you'll see that they're accepted widely. We also think that the IB is scored differently, and so that is obviously missing from the bill, and it actually leads us to the point that I really want to make, which we think that specifying the scores in statutes is not advisable, because if things change, the metrics change, we would have to go back and change the statute as well. So we would urge you to reconsider specifying the scores in the bill and suggest instead that students refer to the policy that we have that's very consistent year to year, another one of your questions, rather than embed specific scores in statute that may require further statutory amendments and may cause more confusion for students. So the AP IB workgroup and the colleges and universities they represent intend to award as many credits as possible. We believe it's motivating for students to understand they're capable of college level work, and it encourages them to use their AP and IP credits and go to college. It is currency for them, and we really respect that. We also want to ensure, though, that students will be successful in the next more advanced course they take, and that's why we appreciate the IB, the work of the AP IB group. So thank you for letting us provide input from the public universities, and we'd be happy to take any additional questions.
Additional questions? I guess I'll say one last statement. You know, having had kids that did, as a parent, I told them get a 4 or 5. It makes it easier.
It does.
They followed the instructions, which was nice. But I will tell you that the changing courses and the not following the sequence, my son, everybody told him he should be a lawyer. He said he wanted to be a doctor. After the first year, he went and into the law part of it. But all those AP courses allowed him to graduate in that nice 4-year frame because he had things that make it happen. And with kids changing as often as they do, having some other credits in some of those other fields can be very, very helpful. So
we are very supportive of awarding credit, as you're well aware. I mean, we're awarding thousands and thousands of credits on every level, dual credit. We have now new standards for assessment-based credit, IB, AP. So there's no problem with that. We're just suggesting that putting the score in statute maybe is not advisable.
Okay. Thank you all.
Thank you very much.
That takes care of all the testimony, so we're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 207. We're going to open. I'm going to go sit down there and be a person to talk about this next one.
Well, that's assuming that the Vice Chair will recognize you.
If he recognizes
you,
that's right.
Where's my cheat sheet? Thank you for pausing there. In case you're wondering, I've got a step-by-step changing of a public, declaring a public hearing on a specific bill. First time to have the gavel in my hand, and my partner here said, don't hit me, right? So I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 6, and I call on staff for a summary of the bill. Senator Roblin, if you'll have a chair as the first witness.
Vice Chair Linthicum, members of the committee. Senate Joint Resolution 6 recommends that school personnel, parents, and students be educated about the health impacts of heavy backpacks. It recommends school scoliosis examinations. It recommends that parent organizations assess the use of overloaded backpacks. And it recommends specific items for schools to consider when conducting backpack education. Directs the Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction to communicate information relating to heavy backpacks to every school district in the state.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, my name is Arnie Roblin. I am a senator from District 5, which is part of seven counties on the coast and a little bit inland, Polk and Yamhill. We have two bills. The following one is going to be an actual statute and a bill as opposed to a joint resolution. And there's a reason for that. We got a request from a person who has been working on this issue throughout the nation, trying to get all states to start having a conversation regarding what backpacks are doing to children. You're going to hear some more medical evidence, I think, next time. But I'm going to start by saying we do have an amendment for this because oftentimes when we put in specific language about medical professionals, that doesn't include chiropractors, and I think they should be in this group. So we'll have an amendment. But we have a growing number of kids with scoliosis and other kinds of back problems in our country. And when you go to schools, as I have, or elementary schools, and see kids wearing backpacks, oftentimes they're wearing them over one shoulder, and they have over 25% of their body weight in those backpacks because those books are heavy. Those things have long-term effects on the kids' health and their ability, as life goes on, to continue to stand up straight and have a healthy, pain-free life. And I in particular, believe that as public education professionals, we need to do everything we can to help kids be healthier, stronger, and prevent them from doing things to harm themselves by putting heavy backpacks on their back in inappropriate ways. There have been developments in backpacks and how to wear them and do other kinds of things, but we don't really have a conversation with that. Parents buy a backpack, kids and people put stuff in them, and then they go forth carrying them, and then don't understand why years later they're having a hard time walking and doing those things. This is just a resolution that basically asks that we have more conversations with people in schools and around about taking care of yourself, wearing things appropriately, and not creating our own injuries to ourselves by the way we use backpacks and move our books around from classroom to classroom. So with that, I'll take any questions people might have.
Any questions? Appears there's no questions.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Absolutely.
I have a couple of other witnesses, as well as if you did not sign up and would like to speak, you are welcome to right now. Marilyn Von Forrester. Please state your name for the record.
Yes, Marilyn Miller Von Forster, Chairman Roblin, Vice Chair Linthicum, and members of the committee. I'm a physical therapist. been a physical therapist for 47 years, a researcher, educator, and clinician, and continue to do so. My focus has been on back health, lifelong healthy movement, and lifelong back health without pain. And I've really been concerned about our students. For decades, I've started working on healthy school chairs, advising school districts, and then very concerned about the backpack issue, and have done some things to solve that myself. I appreciate the opportunity to address this epidemic affecting our children. The problem we're talking about is back pain, strain, postural distortion, and the long-term effects of school backpack use. From a clinical perspective, the solution is to teach the body skills of good posture, good body mechanics with everyday activity, and to load the body with good posture using an axial loading system that does not distort posture with increasing load. I applaud this issue being before you. Since the 1970s, not before, 1970s, children have been using backpacks to carry their school books and have suffered the consequences. Since backpacks are off-axis loads, they're not on the vertical axis of the body spine, posture immediately has to adjust. And if the load is increased, postural distortion increases. This combination of loading in increasingly poor posture for prolonged periods every day is the recipe for pain and injury. If backpacks continue to be used for school, it is crucial to reduce the weight a child should carry in his or her backpack. This is important to reduce the problem, but it is not a solution. The strategies of addressing this problem over these 40 plus years have been largely ineffective because they only address the weight carried and the manner in which the bag is worn and adjusted. This bill again addresses predominantly the weight of the load carried, not the posture associated with the design of the bag itself. If the load is transferred to a loading system that aligns with the body's vertical axis, postural tone is enhanced and pain is relieved or greatly reduced with the same load. There are two other significant public health issues directly related to this discussion: osteoporosis, and deaths from opioid misuse. Osteoporosis is a pediatric disease that usually manifests itself later. Prevention of this disease can only happen during the growth period when the weight-bearing activity is crucial for bone density development for a lifetime. Carrying weight is important and beneficial, not harmful, as long as it is done moderately and axially with good posture. The opioid epidemic is predominantly the result of misuse of pain medication, most often prescribed for back pain. Back pain often begins in childhood, usually related to backpack use, which causes postural distortion and poor movement habits, like what you have to do in order to sit down. You do all the things that we as physical therapists and chiropractors teach our patient not to do, and that to bend, twist down with a heavy load and have to get that back up and get on again, right? And it's usually done with the same arm. So there's a lot more than back issues. There's also shoulder. There's a lot of issues here. And so I'm trying to make it brief. But there's a lot with the design of the bag that's causing these problems. Okay. Students that move their load from their backpack to a bilateral axial loading system are relieved of their pain and experience improved posture, the foundation of spinal health. This legislation could be a gold mine for addressing all of these problems if worded thoroughly for effectiveness. Textbooks, when carried in methods described, would then increase their value in education from not only their academic subject, but also physical education for the most important lifelong movement skills of all. Good posture and healthy movement in everyday activity, while also increasing postural strength. The basis of healthy bones, pain-free bodies, and a positive outlook throughout life. In conclusion, knowledge is available to effectively solve this problem. I would like to be a resource for you and the Department of Education in creative ways to implement the knowledge effectively and simply. I would like to suggest that you please make the following addition to SR 216 and SJR 6. School bags must load the body with good posture, using an axial loading system that does not distort posture with increased loading. Thank you, and I'd love to have questions. This is a very complex issue.
Any questions? Oh, it's not me. It's you. No. Yeah, that's right. Good job.
Any questions for Marilyn? You explained it very well. Thank you for your time, and thanks for volunteering to help. We
Thank
appreciate
you.
It. Let's see. I have one other individual, Vern Sabo. Is Vern here? Come forward. Please announce your name for the record, and we're happy to hear your testimony.
For the record, Dr. Vern Sabo, representing the Oregon Chiropractic Association, I will make my comments brief. Relative to the comments by Senator Roebland indicating a possibility for amendments, in page 2, subsection 2, it states recommend that licensed medical professionals who are trained in recognizing the indicators of scoliosis conduct school scoliosis examinations. Is that the section? I don't think licensed medical professionals excludes
That's what
anyone.
Hoping.
No.
I didn't think so.
I just want to make that
comment. I
wasn't
sure, but in conversations we've had, sorry.
Is that this bill?
No, it's actually the next bill. It looks 16. Like it's 216. We're
okay.
Right now on Senate Joint Resolution 6.
Okay.
But it's the same conversation.
Yeah, a similar conversation, both backpack safety.
Yeah.
Right. So, that's all the comments I wanted to make. I do appreciate.
I appreciate with that too, because I was in a conversation earlier today, and I didn't think they were held the same way. So it's good.
Great, thank you.
Any other individuals who would like to testify on Senate Joint Resolution 6? Seeing no others, the public hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 6 is closed.
And I want to first say thank you very much for doing that, and I wish I could control myself. So you were very kind to me to not call me out of order. So with that, we're going to open our last bill, Senate Bill 216. We'll have a short explanation by our administrator, and I think, Vern, you want to come up? You can get ready for that.
Chair Roebland, members of the committee, Senate Bill 216 directs the Oregon Department of Education to prepare information about the health impacts of heavy backpacks and possible measures to avoid backpack-related injuries. It directs the department to make this information available to school districts and to identify best practices for school districts to disseminate the information.
And it's the other one, Marilyn. Mm-hmm. And Marilyn can come up, too. You can come on up.
Chair Roland, members of the committee, for the record, Dr. Vern Sable, representing the Oregon Chiropractic Association. This bill's straightforward. It's simply directs the Department of Education to disseminate information about this important topic. and that being backpacks, school backpacks that are too heavy and worn improperly. And what we're recommending, what we've proposed and suggested to the Department of Education is simply a PDF electronic form versions of the information disseminated to the school districts to make it painless, to make it hopefully very little of a cost or burden to the school districts or the Department of Education. So this is the example of one of the PowerPoint slide presentations regarding covering the key points of the issue. This is in English. We also produced it in Spanish, Vietnamese, and Russian. We also have, and I'll show you at the tail end, one-page informational sheets that are also in those four languages and a trifold pamphlet that the school districts can utilize as they see fit, all of which could be disseminated to the school districts by the Department of Education in electronic form. So we know that too heavy of backpacks worn improperly result in some 7,000 ER visits every year. This is based on the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission. 90% of the kids wear backpacks that are as much as 25% of their body weight. Of those carrying heavy backpacks, some study shows as many as 60% experience back pain as a result. Some of the potential health issues are chronic back pain in our children, chronic neck pain, headaches, damage to soft tissues of the shoulders, hip, knee, falls, microstructural damage to the nerves, chronic inflammation, and even damage to internal organs. Excuse me. So wearing backpacks improperly, again, we're showing the spine here. There is no good evidence-based information that suggests that heavy backpacks will result in scoliosis. However, the congenital basis, congenital scoliosis in children, once they're going into the growth spurts and they're into the development of a scoliosis, there's no good evidence that they won't, heavy backpacks worn improperly will not facilitate scoliosis or worsen that. So some of the recommendations, better habits, the backpacks should not be any heavier than 10% of the child's body weight. They should not be worn any lower than 4 inches below the waist. Options such as leaving some of the heavy books in the classroom or in the locker, and also using some of the roller carry bags are also suggested. So basically that is what the issue is, what we're recommending to the Department of Education to be disseminated to the school districts, and again in those four languages, and this PowerPoint presentation, which teachers could simply show to their students, is simply 8 slides long. And so we wanted to make this information, just get this important information out to the school districts, but not make it a burden or costly. That completes my testimony. I'd be willing to answer any questions you might have.
We'll go next to Marilyn, and we'll have questions for both of you. You get to go next. So.
Well, I did my thing already, but my point is...
And make sure you identify yourself again for the record.
I'm Marilyn Miller von Forster, physical therapist in Salem. In the goal of educating the public, I just would like to make sure that they understand that it's the real issue has to do with the load being placed on the body in an off-axis manner. In other words, some solutions, I suppose, well, there are lots of solutions out there, and I even created one myself because I felt an obligation that we have to have a healthy alternative. But we could take 2 shoulder bags, or what they do in third world countries, I'll bring this up. The only way to make one bag on your vertical axis on the head, right. So our culture is not ready for that. That's why a bilateral system can become on the vertical axis. If you're having backpacks, I would suggest maybe twice a week, a backpack backwards day, to wear it in the front instead of the back, just to compensate for the constant postural distortion of wearing it on the back. We could collaborate with all kinds of creative ideas, but in my view, it's the... I'll just give you a little history. In the 70s, the outdoor market became flat for backpacks. So JanSport said, let's hit the day use market. That's unlimited. That's when backpacks became available as school bags. They were not designed to be school bags. They were designed to be mountain climbing and outdoor bags. The design has been the wrong design for this use. And if we really want to radically solve the problem, we need to make a different design that loads the body properly. But meanwhile, we have billions of backpacks, and the students are using them, and I think this is very valuable information for those who are using. But I think we shouldn't limit it to just thinking that a backpack is the same thing as an apple for school symbol. You know, it's not a it should not be, it's causing harm. So that's my mission, is to get that information clear, and we work together and doing the best we can to get the kids healthy and straight. It's the best I can say.
Thank you very much. Any questions for either of these people? I appreciate passion in teachers at school and all things, and so I appreciate both of you taking the time to come out of your busy schedules to talk about it, which I do think is really important. I saw way too many kids that were suffering because we had them carrying these books around. And it got to the point at some places in high schools where it was load them up, see who could load the biggest backpack and carry it around. That was not a good right. deal. So with that?
If we see from our clinical perspective the pain that is constant. And now we have pain medication being...
That's true, overprescribed.
It's getting to the young people because they don't think that they can... They're just going to school. They don't realize that their backpack is what's causing this chronic pain. So it's a very serious issue.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that would like to come forward? I don't see anyone. I won't call anybody my name. So with that, we're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 216. Thank you, committee, for all being here. I can't think of anything else unless Senator Cruz has something he wants to say. He's been very quiet, so I'll give you an opportunity before we close.
I was dependent upon Senator okay. Haas to cover all the major issues
okay.
for
me. Very good. Thank you very much. With that, we will close our Senate Education Committee today. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Education Committee today. Thank you very much.